nice to see you again. I was just thinking as I was sitting there how amazing the truth is that it's been a couple of years probably since I've seen a lot of you, and that, you know, we have the bonds immediately established. So it doesn't matter whether we haven't seen each other for 6 days, 6 months, 6 years, we have that bond. And it was really brought home to us at the weekend. We had a wedding and we're sitting looking across these old people on the other side of the hall thinking, gee, they look familiar. And looking across the room to us thinking, oh, and it's been 25 years since we'd seen a lot of these young people as they were, we thought, back then, from Perth. And, you know, what a wonderful thing we have here in the truth. Since I've seen you last, we've actually moved a bit closer, so that's good. We live instead of Cessnock, we've moved now to Dora Creek. So Gary and I are teaching 3 days a week at the new site, Heritage College, Lake Macquarie. So that's 3 minutes away from home, not 43, so we're very happy with that. And the school up there is going brilliantly. Leah Crawford is deputy principal now and she's doing amazing things. So if you hear anything about it up there, come onto the site. It's a beautiful new site and it's going very well.
I haven't heard about it at all.
Okay, so Heritage College Currumbong was in a rented premises. And so they've same school, but they've moved to a new site. It's now called Heritage College Lake Macquarie. It's just near Morisset. And we've gone from 70 children to 150, and it's really going fantastically. So Gary and I teach 3 days a week each, to get the same days, so it's really good. We're sort of semi-retired, but we're still getting some money, so it's good. we found you do need money, unfortunately. Okay, so Amos. Now, I started the reading from 2 Kings. Sorry, I'll have to stand on the teacher. I don't think if I sit down. So Amos is set in this time of 2 Kings during the reign of Jeroboam II. When I teach the HSC students on the kings of Israel and Judah, we look at Jeroboam, and he actually reigned 41 years. So he was one of the longest reigning kings in Israel. So look how few verses are there that tell us about him. So when we look at stay here in Kings, but when we look at the first verse of Amos, we find that you've got the words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake, when Uzziah was king of Judah and Jeroboam the second was king of Israel. So that puts us into this time period. And now when we look at what happens here, you can understand the society of the time. When we look at the king's records, it's not much about what it's like. There's some military achievements. But when I'm teaching this to the HSD students, we go straight into Amos and Hosea, because that gives the description of the society at the time. So when we look at Uzziah, okay, so he was the king of Judah. Can you see, Wendy? Okay. You can see that, well, I'll go back to this map just to start with. So Uzziah was under control of Judah during the time of Amos' prophecy, and Jeroboam had Israel. You can see the borders of Israel have been extended, and that was picked up in the reading, and also the borders of Judah had extended as well. So it was a very prosperous time, and it was a very comfortable time, a very secure time. We won't deal much with Uzziah, because Amos actually has his message mainly to Israel. He has a brief message to Judah, but most of it is to Israel. But Uzziah, you'll see he's often referred to as Azariah, that's his other name, and we can see the dates when he was reigning there. So you can see how the borders reached with Israel and Judah, the full extent of what it was like under the reigns of David and Solomon. So it was their past glory being renewed. Not only was Hosea and Amos during this time, but Isaiah also did some prophecy as well. So this time for Isaiah in Judah was a time of incredible building. And when you look at his record in Chronicles, wow, lists of building, you know, he built here and he built towers and he built towns and extended right through into here. But we know it was also a time of a massive earthquake. And in Amos chapter 1, it talks about this as a message he got 2 years before the earthquake. And it must have been a significant earthquake, because 250 years later, they're still talking about it, and Zechariah can say the great earthquake at the end of the time, in Zechariah 14, is going to be bigger
than the earthquake in Isaiah's time. So, communally, they must have known what that earthquake was like. It would be like us saying, remember that earthquake in Lisbon in 1770? And we don't have any, connection with that. But they still had a connection with that earthquake in Isaiah's time. Maybe 9/11 will come into our thoughts like that. But, certainly this earthquake was very, very significant. And so, we have Amos then talking about concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake. I can see part of my slides here is cut off about the Beeraim. Okay, let's focus more on Jeroboam then. So just having a look at the record here that was read, you can see that he reigned for 41 years. He restored the boundaries of Israel way up to the north, came into Libo Hamath, right down to the Dead Sea. And who else was prophesying at that time? Someone had told a prophecy that Jeroboam was going to spread the borders like this. And if you look at verse 25, it's Jonah. We don't have any record of that prophecy. That's Jonah and the fish and Nineveh and all that sort of stuff. But he also had other messages which we don't have a record of, but he had prophesied that those borders of Israel were going to be expanded like that. But Israel was suffering, okay? It was a time when they were suffering under the Arameans, which is modern-day Syria, the Moabites and the Ammonites. So they were suffering under the oppression of those nations around them. Jeroboam came in and subdued those nations and gave them this period of relief, period of grace for part of that 41 years. But what we see, though, the people didn't appreciate it. Right. They were apostate, they were pagan, they were unjust, they were liars, they were greedy, and they didn't allow that period of time as a time to reconnect with God. And so Amos comes in, well, it's going to be certain judgment on you because you don't respond to God. So just a little, these few verses here just tell us more about his military achievements, but we know that Amos says, my sword will rise against Jeroboam. So we know Amos was late in Jeroboam's reign, and you can see here that this part here, that the king's record just picks up his military achievement. No idea what society is like from those verses. That's why we have to go back to Amos and Hosea, who both prophesied during this time. So that's the background. They've actually been able to work out the actual date of the earthquake, and it's in my notes that I can't see, but it was 791, something like that. I can give you the exact date because the Assyrians have a record of the earthquake and an eclipse at this time, and I can give you the specific date. Okay, so let's come over to Amos. The Israel Amos, and always one of those tricky ones to find. And we see from the first verse there that I had on the screen the words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake, right? It was that earthquake that was imprinted in everyone's mind, when Uzziah was king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, was king of Israel. So it's at the end of Jeroboam's reign and near the beginning of Uzziah's reign. And we see that the Lord's going to roar from Zion. Okay? It's a strong message. He's going to roar from Zion with this message. But Amos wasn't brought up in the royal household. He was just a shepherd. And he says this when he appeals to some of the royal class. I wasn't no prophet. I wasn't even a prophet's son. But God's called me, and I have to speak. God said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. Must have been very difficult for him. He wasn't a learned man, but he must have had a passion in his message, and he couldn't not preach it because he was God. And so he came not as one who was born a prophet. Okay, so we know that Amos lived in Judah. He prophesied during the reigns of Uzziah and Jeroboam. and we know that he was sent to the north. The main message was given in Bethel. So remember, back in history, Jeroboam the first set up the calf worship in Dan and Bethel. So Amos is sent to Tekoa, which is just south of Jerusalem, about 15 k's away from Jerusalem, to Bethel, which is about 20 k's north of Jerusalem, and that's where he gave his message, just in Bethel.
Well, let's have a look at his message. I'm really annoyed at this because I did it on a Mac and it's a different PowerPoint, but we can have to make... Okay. God's patience with the nation is finished. It's just the way it's configured when we transfer it. But have a look here. The first few chapters of Amos against the nations. Now you imagine, Amos is coming to Bethel and he starts prophesying against, oh, three sins of Damascus, even for four, he says in chapter 1, verse 3. And then, that's it, oh, it's now against Gaza. And the people say, yes, this is our enemy, yes, God's going to punish our enemy. Oh, verse 9, for three sins of Tyre, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. Yes! Another enemy in Israel's being planned. Oh, go Amos, great prophet, we love you. Okay, verse 13, for three sins of Ammon, even for four, I will not... Oh, yes! Go for it, go Ammon, yay! You know, and you can imagine that he was drummed up fantastic support, because he's giving a prophecy by God against all the enemies around Israel. Oh, yes! For three sins of Moab, even for four. Well, oh, yes! You know, go on, go on, get rid of Moab, yes! And all these messages are coming through. And what I want to think of is, Amos just didn't go to Bethel and go, three chapters of Amos in one go. I believe he would have come and gone. Okay, he would have had a message against Gaza. Would have had a message against Damascus. This would have taken 12 months to hear. It wasn't just like we picked up the book and read it. I think he would have come with a message and they would have absorbed it. Yes. There would have been this time of great popularity for Amos's message. He's just a little shepherd. He's come in. He's got a great message. Yes. Then he comes over. Oh, I'm sitting a bit closer now. Chapter 2, verse 4. For three sins of Judah, even for four, I'm not... Oh, wow! Judah, they're not like us, you know? Israel. All these other places are being condemned. Damascus, Gaza, Tyre, Ammon, Moab, Judah. Not us. We're great. Israel is good. You know, we're prosperous. God must be blessing us. And he's condemning all the other nations. Oh, go Ammon, we love you. Think you're great. Go! You know, that's sort of a response to Ammon's message. It was fantastic. Then suddenly, chapter 2, verse 6, for three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. So he now turns his message to Israel. And the rest of the book basically is to the nation of Israel. So it's under the control of Jeroboam. Basically, consultation was finished. He warned them, warned them, warned them. No, that's it. No more, no more. And he was going to judge this unfaithful, absolutely disobedient nation, covenant breaking, terribly immoral, right, and in love. Why had his patience run out now? Why? What was so bad about this nation that God said, a loving God, a gracious God, doesn't want to see anyone perish? But he said no. Why? Because we know that God had called for those people to reflect him in their everyday life. And they didn't. And he called for social justice as an expression of their love. And that's what he does with us. He expects us to demonstrate him in every aspect of our life. We can't compartmentalise God and say, this is my Sunday God, and well, he's not much about every other day of the week. I can do dodgy business deals, I can do this, I can be rude, I can be angry, I can do anything. No, he wants us to show him in our everyday life, and that's what they didn't do. Have a look at Amos 5. This is his appeal to them that they just didn't do. In Amos 5, verse 24.
Let justice roll on like a river. Let righteousness be like a never-failing stream. Your justice is everywhere in the society. Righteousness is shown throughout society. But they didn't. So God had tried to show them that he had been so generous to them. And when you look through chapter 2, you can see how he picks out, oh, you are my chosen people. I have selected you. You are my chosen people. I brought you out of Egypt. I looked after you for those 40 days. When you got into the land, I would have helped you take the land. Under David and Solomon, I allowed you and. But you've just thrown it in my face. You have no appreciation at all for what I've done. The people continually, just continually fail to hear God and show any appreciation at all. They just totally dismiss the history that they have. What happened? He had Jeroboam, had extended the borders, he got rid of the enemies. They were complacent. They felt comfortable. They didn't thank God anymore. In fact, it proved that God was with them because they were so blessed. Oh, you know, we're so rich, we've got everything we want. God must be blessing us. And they were so complacent when you have a look at chapter 6, verse 1. Alright, woe to you. You are complacent in Zion and who feels secure on Mount Samaria. They felt that was their proof that God was with them. And when the day of the Lord comes, the day of the Lord, woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. Oh, that wasn't going to be against them. That was against everyone else. Oh, we're right with God. We must be because we're so blessed. With our material goods, God must love us. But, of course, he says there, I will not accept, I have no regard, and I will fear you no longer. So, I think this is the challenge to us from Amos. They genuinely thought that the performance of ritual was all they needed. They didn't feel they needed a personal connection with God. They didn't have that. There wasn't a realness there with their relationship with God. And I think that's something that we've got to really watch out, is that we just don't go through the motions, Sunday morning worship, but we actually have a personal relationship with God. We mentioned about the brethren and sisters or other Christians in other parts of the world. They don't have any ritual now to rely on. When they're in a prison, waiting for being deported back to Iran, what have they got? They've only got their personal relationship with God to hold on to. Ritual's not going to carry them through. And so they thought because they offered sacrifices, whatever they were meant to, that everything would be right with God. But that's the appeal, I think, that they want. And the real warning for us is that we just don't rely on our rituals. We have to have a real relationship with God. We have to have a real relationship with each other. Right? Genuine love of the brethren. And that's what God looks for. Because we see that they were cheaters. They perverted the justice. Perverted justice that absolutely crushed the poor. And as I said, they thought they, because they were prosperous, that they must be blessed by God. But it was actually that prosperity, and we know what it's like today with our prosperous world. Do people have time for God? Of course they don't. But they're quite comfortable. Why do I need God? I've got everything I need. I've got a big house, a car, a boat. No, I've got everything I need. Why do I need God? And that's basically what they were reduced to. Okay, now let's have a look at these sins that he highlights here in the chapter. Tragic reflection on society. This is why I go into Amos and I'm teaching it to the themes, because this is showing them what the society was like during Jeroboam the second term. Chapter 2, verse 6. They sell the righteous for silver, and the needy for a pair of sandals. They sell people just so they can buy a material good. They trample on the heads of the poor and upon the dust of the ground and deny justice to the oppressed. What? Father and son use the same girl and so profane my holy name. They go up to the pagan house and worship God using a temple prostitute. They lie down beside every altar and garment taken in pledge. In the house of their God, they drink wine taken as fine. Absolutely no moral constraint at all. Have a look at chapter 5. Verse 10. You hate the one who reproves in court. You despise him who tells the truth. You trample on the poor, verse 11, and you force him to give you grain. You, the wealthy one, you're forcing this poor man to give you grain as a bribe? What sort of a society are you? Verse 12. I know many of how many your offences and how great your sins. You oppress the righteous and take bribes. You deprive the poor of justice in the court. Come on to verse 8. No, chapter 8 in the court. This just increases the list of their depravity, their sins, their lack of sensitivity to their brethren. Verse 4, chapter 8, hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor in the land. When will the new moon be over? When will we, when that we can sell grain? Oh, let's get this Sabbath over so we can get back to marketing our wheat. Oh, come on, when's it over? Quick, okay, good. Back into selling, you know, just tolerating the requirements that God has put in place. They skimp the measure, boost the price, they cheat with dishonest scale. They actually rig it up so it's in their favour. They buy the poor with silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, selling even the sweetings with the wheat. So they gather up all the bits on the ground, put it back in the wheat, by having a total unjust measure. So you can see how tragic the society has become. And you imagine Amos just being a shepherd, right? Would have been rough in his clothing, fairly simple man used to being outside. Imagine how they responded when he came in verse 13. Chapter 4. You imagine the women coming along, mincing as they went with all these garb, right? Very wealthy, very proud of their position in society. Oh, they've got the nicest pair of sandals on. So they just sold a poor person to buy them. And look at this message that the Amos turns on them. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan! You know, they, whoa! No, you imagine the response the women would have had and kicking back to their husbands and shutting this Amos guy. You women who oppress the poor and crush the needy. And you say to him, hey, bring us drink! Come on, man, look after us! And if their time will come, will surely come, and you'll be taken away with hooks, and the last of you with fishes. Okay, so you can imagine how he really got everyone mad up, because this message was really harsh to the people who were very complacent and very comfortable.
You know, you often picture them men, you know, when you're reading along, you do this and you do that,
yeah.
Until you get to that bit, you picture the men that are doing all this oppressing. Over and over, probably.
Yeah, because the safety of the women were involved as well.
And then you get it first like that from the world.
Yeah.
Thank goodness for equality.
Okay, well, that's how chapter 3 talks about their absolute opulence. And, just chapter 3, beginning, gives us a little bit of an insight of the rural life and interaction with, you know, lions and birds and things like that.
And you can see in verse 12 that the shepherd saves from the lion's mouth, only two legs, only a piece of an ear. So you can see how he's drawing on his own experiences as a shepherd, where he's rescued his poor shepherd. There's not much left of it because the lion has devoured it. But there's going to be that little bit of Israel that's going to be saved. Verse 14, on the day I punish Israel for her sins, I will destroy the altars of Bethel. The horns of the altar will be cut off and torn to the ground. I will tear down the winter house, along with the summer house, houses adorned with ivory. I'll be destroyed, and the mansions will be demolished. So they had summer houses, they had winter houses. We know that they had lush vineyards. Later on it talks about their beds being inlaid with ivory.
They must have been killing elephants.
Yes, on the other side of the world somewhere, yes. But it talks about the abundance of feasting they went on with. There was no lack of anything. But in that process, they deprived the poor. They had no feeling in all their wealth for those poor on their street. They would walk past them as they would go up to the temple to worship and not have one care for those poor that God loved. So, there was going to be total destruction. God was sick of warning them, and you can see in chapter 4 he gave them lots of warnings. Okay, he gave them empty stomachs in verse 6, lack of bread, so he caught famine. Did that sort of wake them up? Let's turn back to God. No. Verse 8, okay, people stagger from town for water. They didn't get drought. They said lack of rain. Does that turn their hearts back to God? No, you've not returned to me. Okay, you send plague and pestilence, obstructive gardens and vineyards with blight and wind, mildew, locusts devour your fig and not. Has that tempted you to return to me? No, I've given you these warnings. You have not taken them. So now I'm going to destroy you. Doesn't matter what I do. I've warned you. You won't return to me. So I will destroy you. And he says there, therefore, I will send you into exile. Okay, this is an Assyrian belief. You can see that in verse 27. Therefore, I will send you, 5:27, I will send you into exile. And even though Amos doesn't name the nation that is going to take them into exile, he says, I will send you into exile beyond Damascus. But Hosea says it's Assyria. Hosea comes along a bit later, whereas Amos tells them, you're going to go into exile, you're going to be punished. He never actually says, it's the Assyrians, so watch out. But Hosea does. Hosea comes in and says, it's the Assyrians that are going to take you captive. And so we know that the Assyrians did that, right? Sargon came down, laid siege to Samaria, took Israel captive, deported over 200,000 captives, took them back to Assyria, resettled them throughout Assyria. You've got a picture here of an Assyrian battalion. So you've got someone here driving his cattle. You've got a deportee here giving a little child a drink out of a skin. Not too clear, but you've got the Assyrian soldiers here marching them back to Assyria. You will be sent to exile. Therefore, I will send you to exile way beyond Damascus. And that happened with the fall of Israel by Assyria under the hands of Sargon II. Amos also saw visions. The beast must have been terrifying for him. I really feel for him in receiving these visions because he was a man of the land. He knew how precious the land was. He was an agricultural man. He used to tend sycamore trees. He used to have his sheep. So when we have a look at chapter 7 and he sent these visions, this must have been absolutely terrifying for him because he knows what devastation locusts can bring. This is what the Sovereign Lord showed me in chapter 7. He was preparing God was preparing this pestilence, a swarm of locusts, after the king's share had been harvested and just before the second crop was coming in. So these poor people, they'd harvest their first crop and they'd sent that to the king for their taxes, and they were desperately waiting for their own crops to come up for themselves. And God was preparing to send a locust plague on them. Oh, and he cried out, oh, please, please, how can our nation survive if you do that? And so God, as you can see then in verse 3, this is what happened. Okay, so as a response to the prophet's plea, he said, no, I won't do that. They deserve it, but I won't do it because of you. And then you can see here in chapter 4, right, he was shown another vision, and he was calling for judgment by fire, and it just devastated the land. We know that in Australia, how fire can just devastate huge parts of the land. And he said, oh, please, don't do that. I beg you, how can Jacob survive? He's so small. But God didn't bring that in the morning either. He said, no, I won't do that. But the next one, he says, I can't stop. I can't hold back any longer. So he gets a plumb line and he measures it against Israel. And they're so out of plumb. So out of plumb. He said, no, I've got to destroy them. Mm-hmm. You can't have a building that's so out of plumb and survive. It's going to be destroyed. And he says there, I will spare them. Mm-hmm. I will spare them, chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 7. The Lord was standing by walls that had been built through the plumb with a plumb line in his hand. So they'd been built through, but they'd been totally warped now by their behaviour. What do you see? Plumb line. The Lord said, look, I'm setting up a plumb line amongst my people Israel, okay, and I'm going to measure them, okay, I'm going to measure them. If they're not plumb with me, I will spare them no longer. I had plenty of warnings, but God says it's time to finish. He saw also in chapter 8 a basket of ripe fruit. What do you see, Amos? Fruit. Well, time is ripe for my people as well. Okay? You see ripe fruit on a tree? You take it. You pluck it off. Okay? And God was going to pluck them out of their land. He was going to bear them no longer. Israel was ready to be plucked and he would bear them no longer. But the message has been given many, many times. Right? He had warned them. And he is not going to forget anything that they've done. What's going to happen to them? Look at chapter 8, verse 8. And this is a reference to the earthquake. Will not the land tremble for this? And all who live in it mourn. The whole land will rise like the Nile and it will be stirred up and then sink like the river of Egypt. So he's talking about this massive earthquake that's going to happen during the time of Uzziah, and it also accompanies the time of eclipse. I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. Okay, so they knew that that was going to be a huge sign for them. Killed by the sword, look at that. I saw the Lord standing by the altar and he said, strike the top of the pillars so the threshold shake. Bring down the heads of all the people, those who are left, I'll kill with the sword. He was going to punish them. He was going to kill them with the sword. Okay, he was going to bring them down. In verse 3, he was going to hunt them. But as they hide, oh, hunt them down and seize them. Verse 4, so they're driven into exile, I'll command the sword to slay them there too. My God is going to destroy these people. In 9 verse 8 he says, surely the eyes of the Lord are on his sinful nation. I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Yes. Yes. And thank God that there is a yes. I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob. Verse 9, I will give the command that I will shake the house of Israel among all nations. But just like a sieve, I'm sieving them out. But there's always little bits left in the sieve. And that's the little remnant that God's going to save. All sinners among my people will die by the sword. all those who say, oh, nothing is going to happen to us, but you bet on it. And Hosea says, bloodshed follows bloodshed. And in the last 25 years of those that nation, there were 6 kings. 4 of them were assassinated, murdered by the person who took over the throne. 1 was killed by the sword, and the other one, the only one, was followed by his son. That was Menahem, whose son was Pekahiah. But if you look at the end of the records of the Israel in 2 Kings 17, this one murders that one, he reigns 3 months, then he's murdered, this one reigns 2 years, and then he's murdered, which is bloodshed following bloodshed, incredible political instability. Like, the nation was out of control. There was no value on human life, not even on the king's life, and that they felt was quite justified to kill. But, okay, and we had that but, yet I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob. And thankfully, right, there is going to be a time of restoration. And fortunately for us, the whole message isn't doom and gloom, as you might think of Amos, because you have these beautiful verses there, chapter 9, verse 11. In that day, I will restore David's fallen tent. I will repair its broken places. I will restore its ruins. And I'll build it up as it used to be. And so we have this beautiful time of restitution. And we had it mentioned earlier in 5, verse 15, when he says, I know, you know, so many of you are oppressing the poor, but hey, those of you who've got ears to hear, seek good, not evil, that you may live, and the Lord God Almighty will be with you, just as you say he is. Hate evil, love good. Love good. Maintain justice in the courts, because the God Almighty will have mercy on the remnant. No matter what happens around us, and we've got to hang on to what's right, what's the truth, under those pressures that we mentioned earlier, that these, Wendy mentioned in a prayer, the pressures that our brethren and sisters are under to hold on to their faith, no matter what happens. God's going to look after them. They're his remnants, they're his precious ones. And we know that he will rebuild. Look at 9 verse 13. Wow, the day is coming when the reaper will be overtaken by the ploughman, the planter by the one who's treading grain. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. It's going to be this time of amazing abundance. It's going to be okay, Amos. In the end, I'll restore everything. But now, I can't deal with these people now. I've tried. But they won't listen. I'm going to just try. I'm going to look after my little remnant. I don't know. Everything's going to be renewed. It's going to be okay. But just for now, I have to destroy them. And he will bring them back in 9:14. I will bring back my exiled people, Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat the fruit. I will plant Israel in their own land. They are going to be uprooted from the land that I have given them. We see Israel in the land today. Right? Sure. They're building ruined cities, they're living in them, they're planting vineyards. But we know that's not the end. That's not the fulfillment of this. Partially, yes, obviously. But we know the time's going to come and they are going to be in the land of abundance and they'll never be uprooted again. Never will they have to fight for their existence and protect their people, because God will be there with his son protecting them. Now we've got to, as we look at this, we've got to be so grateful. We know God has this amazing, glorious future for the people of Israel. We have all this devastation spoken about in Amos, against all the other nations, against Judah, against Israel. He has judgment, even for our world. His patience is going to run out. But we know that, and we can see how things are escalating. Russia, Ukraine, now the EU have been blocked from providing food to their people. How's Russia going to eat? They get most of their food from the EU. We send over $400 million a year of food to Russia. Now they've blocked all that. How's Russia going to eat? What are they going to do?
The fact that this is happening in the Ukraine,
well, what's going on there? What's happening in Europe? Right? It's just the world's in chaos. It doesn't matter where you look, it's in chaos. God's going to bring his judgment. There's nothing surer. And we know, though, that God's not going to abandon his chosen people, just like he never abandoned his little band of people. He looked after them. He was going to protect us, and they would be renewed in the land. And fortunately for us, we know that God will also be the universe. If you didn't know that, what would you be looking at the world today? Oh, you see what's happening in Africa, and just the drugs in South America. It doesn't matter where you look. The world's crazy. Man's gone crazy. But we know that God's got us in his hand, and at a time when his patience can be no longer, he will send his son back. And we can see that from these few verses here in Amos, that we know that God is in control. chapter 4, verse 13. He who forms the mountains, he creates the winds. He actually reveals his thoughts to us. He who turns dawn to darkness every morning, we wake up and the new day, God's thought, that for us. He treads the high places of the earth. God's in control. God's Lord Almighty is his name. Chapter 5, verse 8. Okay, this little part in parenthesis talks about the amazing things of his creation. Oh, he made liberties. He made Orion. That's awesome. The 80s, 5 to 7 stars. We can only really see 5. But he talks in Job about the 7 stars of the 80s. And it wasn't until the sunset kind of revealed that. He turns blackness to dawn, darkness down into night. He falls to the waters of the sea. He falls to flash of destruction. You know, God's in control. He's doing well for us. Don't worry. Don't worry. God is in control. In chapter 9. The Lord Almighty. It touches the earth and it melts. And all who live in it mourn. The whole land rises like the Nile and sinks like the river of Egypt. He who builds the lofty palace in the heavens. He sets its foundations on the earth. He calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out all over the face of the land. The Lord is his name. Okay. It's okay. God's in control. He's going to punish our world as he did in Israel. He warned Israel, he warned Israel, he warned Israel. They wouldn't listen. They took comfort in their prosperity. Conducted their rituals. That's it. Well, now sacrifice. Good. Now when can we start coming? Okay? And it was all about them, their wants, their desires. Had no compassion for the poor at all. And we can be grateful that we know Israel has a relationship with God. We all do, although they don't know it. We know God's got an amazing plan for Israel. But thankfully, we're part of that plan. We are part of that plan, as you can see in that quote from Colossians. God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of his mystery, which is Christ in you. The hope of glory. So we've got an amazing hope. Just like Amos at the end of his tragic message was given this time of hope, so we have a wonderful hope. And we've got to make sure that we have a wonderful relationship with God, a wonderful relationship with his son, a wonderful relationship with each other, that our religion is real, it's not just a set of rituals. Otherwise, when Jesus comes back, we've got to say, I don't know you. I don't know you. Because you never knew me.